Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Since Cheryl Strayed walked the Pacific Crest Trail, there's been a best-selling book, a Hollywood movie, and now she gives advice to other lost souls. She's going to be our guest in about 20 minutes. Now, Cheryl Strayed is in a creative field. Her job is not going away, but let's travel to the future now and step into a different kind of job site. Let us say the fish and chips joint of the future. Okay, inside, the manager is planning her next promotion. She's thinking about who's coming in to the fish and chips joint, what they want to eat, and she's doing this using big data. Data plans a menu. Data even says what music to play. The restaurant industry is just one workforce that will be transformed by artificial intelligence. How do we prepare for that future? My next guests are Rob Gerling, who runs a Seattle company called Artifact Group, specializing in human-centered design. Cesar Keller is the founder and CEO of the tech startup Workplace 21. He's an investor who studies the future of work and education. So, the restaurant industry, that's where a lot of people have their first jobs. So I asked Cesar, what will artificial intelligence do to those restaurant jobs?
So let me give a very simple example that is super important for a restaurant owner, for example. It's super hard to plan today, like who you're going to hire, right? Like to come, for example, to wait on tables, right? So if you use that technology and you know the demographics, and at the same time you have a professional profile, like as part of different apps and different solutions, what you can do is just like a simple match to say like, who is the ideal wait profile to actually help your customers every time of the day.
So fewer jobs, because the idea for the restaurant operator is not to waste their labor costs, right?
Not necessarily fewer jobs on that example. And that's one that I like a lot, the future, because that's not about job elimination necessarily, but actually have a better match of the right professional to your business. So for example, you say like if early in the day you have an older demographic, you can have like also a profession that has like a good profile to actually wait on those tables and engage in good conversations and entertain more the table. If you have like a business hour and people like a super fast and want to go, so you can also have that same demographic, right? Like, so good examples of how to better deploy these profiles of employees to the business.
Rob, when you hear about the restaurant of the future, what are you hearing?
I think if you look at the small family restaurant, there's kind of one set of scenarios. If you think about the big franchises, the big Burger Kings and whatnot, there's incredible pressure on them to optimize the performance of the humans. And that's where I'm a little worried that the sort of quantification of everything, like people will be studied by the systems and the systems will try to optimize their performance.
What about that worries you?
Well, it's a little bit like imagine being told what to do by a sort of disembodied voice that is in fact the AI system that is managing the restaurant. That's not that far-fetched.
But what if the disembodied voice is smarter than the boss's voice that used to tell you what
right.
to do?
Right, and a little bit omnipotent, right? It's sort of connected to all of the sensors in the restaurant. It's connected to, it's watching all the performance of all of the individuals, and it's ranking their performances. It's constantly evaluating and trying to optimize their performance. And I just sense that where we're going, if you go down that road just a little way, conceptually what you get to is essentially becoming a robot yourself, like all the humanity taken out of any kind of, particularly in a fast food restaurant where essentially they're just trying to eliminate errors. They're optimizing for the, you know, thousandth of a second in terms of performance. They're not really so concerned about the community engagement or the sort of, you know.
So you're just not talking about people being replaced by robots, but they're still people, but they're behaving as if they might as well be robots.
Exactly. And then it just becomes a question of time before they are actually displaced by robots because, you know, robots are tireless. They don't show up for work late. They can work 24/7 and not need a break and all of those things. So what worries me there is just this sort of steady optimization of the workforce. We're all going to be sort of quantified and scored and ranked, and that will become a part of a profile that's out there in the world that gets you a job. And if you're not a good performer, somehow that's going to, you know, count against you.
And, okay. I want to talk about the robot workforce. I just, Caesar, any reaction to that flip side way of looking at the restaurant and jobs of the future?
Absolutely. I love Rob's perspective because it's so true. One aspect that I love about that conversation is to say probably flipping burgers is not the dream job of, like, anyone. Like, you do it because you need a paycheck. You need to pay your studies, right? You know, that's why you do. So when you look at historically how technology has been actually eliminating jobs, this is not new news, right? Like, technology has been eliminating jobs like factory jobs, coal miners, right? Like, you name it. Like,
yes.
So the jobs that actually technology tends to eliminate are the jobs that not necessarily you miss the job itself. You might miss the paycheck. So what actually tell us is in this new wave of technology is we can actually look at the future and see a future where the kind of jobs that will be there will be actually using better our human capabilities. We can maybe think on an augmented human being with more technology. And actually what's hard to manage is the transition from where we are now to that future, because that has been in every single industrial revolution in the past. So it's not about the future. Future is always better because technology makes our lives better. The problem is how do we transition when you have like such an intense wave of technologies.
Rob, we've had industrial revolutions before, as Caesar says. They've created lots of new jobs, arguably better jobs. How do you look at that transition?
We should be excited about new technologies that are going to take away the drudgery. But actually, I think people are really fearful. I think the perception is that my economic livelihood, my autonomy, my sort of meaning as a human, and my identity as in my job is a very important part of an essential part of living in a modern society. And if you are threatening me with displacement by a robot or an AI algorithm or a machine learning system, I'm fearful of that. And I, of course, want to reject it.
You're personally fearful, or you're fearful how people are going to a backlash when people's identities are threatened?
I do feel there will be a backlash. I really think we're, unfortunately, on a track where our kind of economic and political system, socioeconomic political system, is not going to adapt quickly or easily to a hugely automated workforce. And as a sort of increasing number of people are sidelined and made essentially unemployable, we're going to face not just a reskilling and educational challenge to do with keeping those people relevant, but really end up with huge portions of society that potentially have no ability to be hired or no social or economic value to our system. So I'm really worried that at some point if we don't manage this transition well, we will end up in a place with real social upheaval. And I think that's the biggest fear. And I hate to sort of pile on to the fears that we all have, because I think there's enough existential fear in our daily lives anyway. But I actually think this is perhaps one of those areas that's people are almost in denial about what's not that far away in terms of change.
You did mention education, and I want to talk about that. That's something that at least we can do something about. And Caesar, you focus a lot on education. How does education, school, need to change?
So that's a big point. And to Rob's point, the future is going to be all about the choices we make today. So it's all about how do we as a society actually face it and actually rule what you want to do with technology and how to deploy them, right? Because one part of this fourth industrial revolution we are going through is the time period. Because like if you look at the first and the second industrial revolutions, they took place in 100 years time frame. The third one, it was like 55 years. This fourth one, like the most conservative projections actually talking about 25 years, top to be full deployed. So what's going to actually happen, to Rob's point?
To have artificial intelligence and big data integrated in virtually every workplace in America.
In everywhere, in every business. Yeah. So when you look at like how this wave will get like a lot of this generation not prepared for their workplace, this is real, right? This is true. So what we need to, it's actually have like a big like discussion and actually make the right choices in terms of how do you actually use all this wealth that will be generated. We talked the restaurant on the beginning. So that restaurant is going to be like way more profitable. And if you apply that for every business, you see like there's a lot of wealth.
Where is there a model of how the education system changes?
So coming back to that, it's super clear that so jobs that has a lower education level will be eliminated. What this industrial revolution is taking us, that's to me is like super interesting, is we have like a lot of more of the what we call the gig economy, jobs paid by hours, and one area that jobs has been growing and will keep growing is what I'm calling caring jobs. So care in terms of like social care, health care, beauty care, like every time there's human touch, there's a lot of that on the gig economy. Like this will actually push us to be probably better humans and take care of each other more. And on the other end of the scale, you have like highly educated jobs, right? So basically, it's, we talk about mode skills. So it's no longer enough to be a lawyer, but you have to be a lawyer that understand computer systems, right? This is a way like crossing points when you're going to do. So what you can do with education, and this is super important, is invest part of that wealth on creating social equity through education. So it's reskilling and upskilling people as fast as possible to actually grab those better jobs, right? Like those more intellectual jobs. We understand that we need to actually revisit like how we see education from like preschool to continuous education in the future to prepare our kids in our like workforce displaced to engage on this work.
You were telling us that Finland doesn't separate education out subject by subject.
That's right. They just actually changed that curricula like in all fundamental school, because actually if you look at the future and you say we are actually going through the information era. So like information is not the key on the schools anymore. What you need is to be sure that we are preparing our kids to actually understand what to do with that information, how to connect that, how to make a good analysis, how to actually understand if a source is reliable or not. So you don't need subjects for that. What we need is actually critical thinking. You need to have cooperation.
I just want to make it clear. There's social studies, and there's history, and there's art, and there's physics, and there's subject by subject. And you're saying Finland just, everything is interdisciplinary?
It is, because you actually propose, or you actually get the students, for example, right? This is one example. You say, let's solve a problem. And they choose a problem to solve. That might be like how to actually have more water in Africa, right? Like you can be anyone. And then what you do, you apply every single, what we call the old subjects, right? You say like, what's the math involved on that? Like how, what's the financial, what's statistics, what?
Psychology, the geography, yeah.
Right, you get every single angle around that. And then you teach students, but with a purpose. Like this is super important.
And of course they're using the modern tools, because everybody is. It's not a separate discipline. Any reaction to modern education, the future of education, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge. Somebody said recently the machine learning revolution will be colorblind, and this idea that white collar, blue collar, or just low skilled jobs are the ones that are going to be displaced is actually another sort of myth. I think all jobs will face some amount of automation. It doesn't matter how sophisticated or how highly trained you are. It's going to show up right next to you, real soon.
In hospitals, in law firms, we're not just talking about
exactly in clinical scientific offices. And it doesn't matter the level of education, almost. So the human qualities, the human properties that, however, that will be the hardest to automate, the things that will sort of hold out the longest. And be resilient longer are in fact the I think sort of technical understanding, sort of an understanding of how these systems work, being proficient with data. That's sort of one area. A second area is creativity and the being having highly skilled people who are capable of asking really good questions and figuring out what are the questions to ask the systems is actually one of the sort of areas that we can find uniqueness. Machines are really good at answering questions, but they're not actually very good at coming up with them. And then the third area is all the sort of skills around social human relationships. That's negotiation, convincing, making arguments, comedy, all of the things that are kind of like the subtlety of humanity. Those three areas are the kind of areas where the sort of machines will have the hardest time displacing us. So if your job involves all three of those, you're going to be safe for a long time.
What job would involve all three of those?
That's a good question. So it's strange. I think nursing comes up quite a lot and occupational therapy and these kinds of therapists are sort of understood. But nursing particularly, because I think there's also an element in nursing, which is the sort of relationship you have with another human and how you empathize and communicate with that individual about pain and suffering and psychology and all of these things, as well as all of the physical things that are to do with treating them, which are actually quite sophisticated or complex physical manipulations. So nursing comes up. There's creativity in the work as well in terms of understanding really what people need versus what they're saying they need and sort of understanding what human psychology to a sort of different level. I'm a designer by training, and I think design actually has a little bit of the sort of creativity. Design thinking has been often bandied around as being a kind of new way of thinking about problem solving.
So, Cesar, part of that falls into what you called the caring industry, but more. So if you have a couple more questions. You're a kid or you've got a kid, being educated, what should that child study?
So first of all, you need to be sure that what you call the soft skills, they are developing those soft skills. Because like if you think on like this future that Rob is describing here, there will be a lot of like how you relate to other human beings and how do you actually create like collective intelligence. So things like cooperation, empathy, you need to be sure that your kids actually are masters on all those social skills. This is super important. The second one is understand if those kids have academic potential, right? Like to actually keep studying. Because one of the quotes that I love about the future is to say, people will be either telling computers what to do or being told by computers what to do. Mm-hmm. So that's either way, in the middle, there's not a lot. So those jobs are gonna tend to disappear. So if you wanna actually go on the academic way, you need to be multi-skilled, you need to go deep, and you need to actually keep developing intellectually as much as you can. And if you allow me like one segue to that thought that I love is to say, when I was in high school, and I was planning which profession I would actually pick. I picked engineering. I actually knew that I would actually choose a profession. I would like go to the university, I would learn, I would be an intern, and I would actually work for 30 years and I would retire happily like after that.
Yeah.
That would be like a 35, 40 year cycle, right? If you actually look at how we are today, especially on technical professions, you need to be completely reskilled in 5 years. Because if you are not, you're completely out of your profession.
So plan to constantly train.
Train. So if you project how actually technology is going fast in the future, that cycle, on my view, that's the projection, is to say it will be job by job, project by project. So basically, you need to be reskilled and upskilled for every job you actually will do. And once you finish, you need to be reskilled and upskilled again for the next one.
Okay.
So that education, the basis, like for the kids today, right? Like if you're a parent, is to actually make kids love learning and have like the growth mindset that we have been discussing a lot here in Seattle, because actually that's going to be the key. We have to be like loving to learn and relearn our professions every day.
You know, not everybody wants to be creative and deal with mystery. I mean, what are we going to do with people whose jobs and skills get eliminated and they don't see a path for themselves? Rob mentioned, you know, social upheaval. Do you have any quick thought on that?
That would be a forcing function for us to actually rethink our careers and understand like how we can actually progress and be productive. But that would be a big push. Like I would add to that list one that the World Economic Forum like are actually adding is like office jobs. That's a big number. Office jobs that have like low decision making, right? Like all repetitive tasks that we do, like those are going as fast as like they have a number. They have like 5 million jobs before 2020. That's like right there, right? Like in 2 years. So we'll actually have to find our new passions. So
it's new passions.
New passions, because if you look at that future, now let's not talk about the next 10, 20 years, that's going to be really tough. But if you look at the future, the main reason that we're going to actually get engaged on working is because we have a purpose. We have something that we want to accomplish. We want to solve a problem. So it's not really about the paycheck anymore necessarily. That's part of the big discussion that we have to have now. But to say, how do actually got the will to develop something that is going to be better for humankind.
We've been talking about today and the future with Rob Gerling, CEO of Artifact Group, a Seattle design and innovation consultancy, specializes in human-centered design and ideation. Cesar Keller, former chief marketing officer for Microsoft Latin America. He has founded a tech startup called Workplace 21. He's the CEO there, an investor in the future of work and education. Please come back and update us. Thank you both.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And if you want to hear more about how artificial intelligence and automation are changing our workforce, Rob Gerling is moderating a panel conversation at Seattle University tonight. And Cesar Keller is one of the panelists. AI and Automation in the Workforce is tonight at 6:30 at Seattle University. You can get tickets at the door or through Town Hall Seattle. We'll be right back on KUOW's The Record with Cheryl Strayed. Stay tuned. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Cheryl Strayed is not the given name of my next guest. When Cheryl Nyland got divorced and changed her life, she changed her name to reflect something true. Cheryl had strayed. You probably know that name because of her book, Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail. Now you might also know her by another name, Dear Sugar. Cheryl Strayed, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, it's great to be here.
You co-host this advice podcast that's produced by the New York Times and a public radio station. How'd you sell those highbrows on personal advice?
Well, you know, I didn't have to sell them. They came to me. But I think that had to do with really the shift in the way we think of advice and frankly, the way advice has been given. Before I had the Dear Sugars podcast, I had the Dear Sugar column on the Rumpus, which was collected in my book, Tiny Beautiful Things.
And you were anonymous at
the
beginning.
Yeah, I was anonymous at the beginning. And what I did from the beginning is really ignore the ways that advice has been given throughout time. That is to say, sit in a superior position and tell people what I thought they should be doing with their lives, but instead really engage them by writing about my life, writing about things, experiences I've had, and not so much trying to tell them what to do, but rather to expand the questions that people were asking me, to illuminate, if you will, the struggles that they were having.
Can you give me an example of how that's different? How's that play out?
Well, I think that, you know, what so many of us, I'm 49, but many of us sort of we came up in that sort of newspaper advice column. Dear Abby, Ann Landers, these were really wonderful women who served, I think, a great role. So this is by no means a criticism of them. But I think what happened in the age of the internet, for example, my column was on a website. I didn't have to be family friendly like you have to be in a newspaper. I didn't have to deliver my thoughts and advice in the course of a paragraph. I got to really engage with it as a writer. And that was my interest, is to really think about how would a novelist write this character, if this person who, you know, who's writing me and telling me their secret or their deepest sorrow or their deepest struggle, if I were writing them as a character, wherever would I go? How would I hold them accountable? Where would I have compassion for them? And so I engaged with them in that way. And what I found myself pretty innately doing was telling stories from my own life. So, for example, a woman wrote to me, she had a miscarriage. She was overweight and she blamed herself for the miscarriage. She was grieving the death of this baby who she never got to have. And in my answer, I told a story about the time that I worked as a youth advocate with at-risk girls in Portland, Oregon. Now, those two things don't seem like they match. Those two stories don't seem like they sit alongside each other. But the way that I wrote at the core issues, how do we deal with the difficult things in our lives? How do we grapple with our suffering and our sorrow? Really were connected. And, you know, that's just one example of the way I did the column over and over again. And this comes up on the podcast, too. My co-host Steve Allman and I share stories from our lives.
Yes, you always start with a story, ones that I've heard. And you've called your podcast Radically Empathic. Right?
Right. Well, somebody else called it that. You know, I didn't give it that subtitle. What happened is when I was writing the Dear Sugar column in the early days, that's what people started calling me in the column. And so, yeah, that was really put onto the podcast.
Well, what's radical about it?
I think by radical, we mean core. That at core, Steve and I, and certainly I in my column, always approached people with what I call unconditional positive regard, by which I mean you can tell me anything. And where I'm going to come at you is not going to be whether you're good or bad or right or wrong or in any way shake my finger at you, but rather accept your story for what it is and do my best to offer you compassion and illumination. And by illumination, I mean so often when people write, they have a question, what should I do? Or did I do the wrong thing? Or what would you suggest I do so this problem is fixed? And almost always what I respond with is a deeper set of questions. That so many of our problems really do come from a core place of some wound that we got long ago. And so I think when we talk about radical empathy, we're talking about empathy that goes to the very core of who you are.
I grew up reading those Dear Abby Ann Landers columns. As a little boy, I was reading those columns.
Right.
And sometimes the advice was, knock it off. You know, I wonder, I can maybe hear my mom's voice saying, sometimes people need to be judged. What do you do with that? Is that just wrong?
I don't think that's wrong, but I think there's more to the story. And so some of the advice that I give in whether it be in Tiny Beautiful Things, in the columns in that book or on the podcast, certainly my listeners and readers often hear me say, no, this is what I think you should do. And there are no two ways about it. But that is not coming from a place of being judgmental.
For example, you're not judgmental about sexual promiscuity, but you'll say, be careful for these reasons. Is that an example of what you're talking about?
You know, often what happens is I will actually tell people what they already know. So somebody who writes to say, I'm struggling because I'm sexually promiscuous and it's making me unhappy, I'll say, stop being sexually promiscuous because it's making you unhappy. Not because being sexually promiscuous is inherently right or wrong. And I think that's what I mean about embracing complexity that transcends judgment. Often judgment, and again, this isn't a comment on Dear Abby. You know, I think sometimes she was right to say, cut it out, right? But almost always, the questions we have are more complex than just right or wrong.
My guest is Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild, made into a film, and she does this podcast now called Dear Sugars, this advice podcast. I want us to talk about the idea of being judged, because in Seattle, I've been getting a lot of people tell me that they feel judged, either by the Seattle political correct thought police, or I'm silenced about this, I'm shut down by that. And I wonder, is that something that you've noticed any more lately? And, well, let me start there.
Yeah.
Do you have a conversation about that a lot with people saying, I feel shamed and silenced and marginalized?
Yeah, I think it's a really actually very fascinating statement in these times, because I think it's true that a lot of people, whole categories of people who didn't feel judged before are now feeling judged. People whose privilege was invisible to them and to the communities around them never got criticized. And suddenly people are saying, listen, you have privilege, you have power that you need to wake up and see. We're going to hold you to account. And I think that these are growing pains of a culture that's in the midst of change. You know, I think that some categories of people have felt judged throughout all time. And so I don't think it's a bad thing to say, yeah, I'm feeling uncomfortable because some of the assumptions I've made are being questioned. I think that the mistake to make, if I were going to give you advice, if you came to me and said, hey, I'm a white guy and I feel judged, mm-hmm. I would say, take a deep breath. Criticism is painful and embarrassing, but it's not the end of the story. That if you can listen to criticism, as we all know, when we're criticized, some parts of it are valid, some parts are invalid. Some things, you know, sometimes you're blamed for something that isn't your fault, and that's an overcorrection. You know, other times it's a lesson that you can learn and that you can use to actually change yourself and evolve. And, you know, so I think that that's a piece of it. I think social media is another piece of it. It's so much easier to criticize people now, right? I mean, back in the old days when people would listen to your show, if they had a complaint, they would have to pick up the phone or write a letter. Now, all they have to do is tweet. They know where to find you. And you know, they're saying things right now, probably on Twitter. Is mm-hmm. this good or bad, right?
And so someone's judging me right now?
That's right. I mean, we have so much more access to either praise or criticize people, which, you know, has an upside. It also has a downside.
Yeah. That is such a much more articulate and empathetic response than sometimes I've basically said, yeah, people judge each other. That's their life. Get on with your life.
See, that's why I'm sugar and you're not.
Exactly. I'm something much more bitter and sour than sugar. This is Cheryl Strayed I'm talking to. You said once, can't remember if it was in your podcast or your column, something like women's liberation is profoundly connected to their shoes.
Yes.
Will you tell me what you mean by that?
You know, I don't know where I said that, but it's so great because I keep getting asked about it. And of course, I guess it's kind of appropriate because my book, Wild, what does it have on the cover? But a shoe, right?
Yeah.
And I want to note, as much as I complained about how much my boots hurt my feet in Wild, that is a liberating shoe. These boots were made for walking, right? And I do think that I find it really amazing that, you know, in every area of life in this nation, we see women really stepping forward and claiming their power and saying, you know, we are independent and strong and free. And they're wearing shoes that you have to hobble in, really, that you can't walk a mile in, that you certainly can't run in. And, you know, I don't mean to be like the proselytizer for like comfortable shoes, but it is.
Are you getting paid by REI?
I'm not being paid by it. I swear to God. But, you know, it is something I would like to think more deeply about. I certainly in my own life, I've thought about that. What am I saying about myself, you know, when I don footwear that I can't move in? And, you know, I do think that there's some liberation to be found in, you know, really reclaiming that you know, shoes for ourselves, shoes that we can run in, shoes that we can walk in.
Well, maybe you should say that, because when I tell my wife that I'd be happy if she didn't wear uncomfortable shoes or she didn't wear makeup, she says, easy for you to say.
Yeah.
The patriarchy makes me.
Well, and I'm on your wife's side. And that's why I think this is a really, I mean, we're talking about this in a kind of funny way, and yet it's really, its roots here again, if we go radical on this, are pretty deep, because of course I also struggle with those things. Do I sometimes wear high heels that kill my feet? Absolutely. Am I wearing makeup right now as I'm talking to you? Absolutely. And it has everything to do with the patriarchy. And so, you know, I don't mean to just say, oh, come on, girls, let's just chuck those high heels out the door. At the same time, that is how change is made. When categories of people, like women, band together and say, we're not going to cooperate with this anymore. And I'm suggesting that I would lead the movement to throw all the high heels out the door.
Okay. Better you than me. There's an advice. I'll write the show. Dear Sugar, I need your advice. I tell my wife not to be uncomfortable on my account, but she still wears heels. Is she having an affair? Signed, the patriarchy.
That's right.
What would you tell me?
I would say that your wife's fashion choices are up to her,
mm-hmm.
and that you should probably butt out. But that she's right. You know, we, women are in a double bind. We are, you know, even strong, independent feminist women want to feel validated by the culture. And that's very connected to the way we look.
That's true. Cheryl Strayed is my guest. And I wonder what you've learned from getting involved in other people's problems. What have you learned?
Oh, so much. So much. It's really one thing I wrote in Tiny Beautiful Things is that I fall in love with every person who writes to me.
I've said that about guests I interview. Seriously.
Yeah.
I've used that same phrase. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, there's a reason for that. Because what you're doing when you're talking to people is you innately are connecting to them, right? Yeah. You're finding out who they are. They walk in here, you see their facade, but the minute you start talking to them, you see who they are, and you feel something like love for them, and that's heightened for me because of course I'm not just getting any old letter. I'm getting a letter where somebody is saying, "Help me. This is my problem." Almost always, this is a very deep sorrow for them or a secret. Sometimes they've written to me things, many times they've written things they've never said to anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way for me not to feel a great amount of compassion and concern for the people who write to me. I really want to be helpful. And here's what's been so cool for me as a writer is, you know, when as a reader, books saved my life. This is where I have found consolation in my greatest sorrows is in the pages of a book. And to be a writer who is actually helping people, who has, you know, sort of like directly, explicitly trying to help others through the work that I write, whether it be on the podcast, the stuff I say, or the things I write, has been a very powerful experience for me. It's given me an even deeper sense of the truth that we are all connected, that we have more in common than not. And that everyone is worthy of our compassion and our consideration and our kindness.
I hear people say, man, these days, 2018 in America, it doesn't feel like people are connected. And I hear people, sometimes the same people, saying, being really dismissive and angry at the people who disagree with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, almost in the same breath. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. How could we be Americans and not know what you're talking about? I mean, there's no question that our nation has become divisive along, you know, very, very black and white political lines. And this has been really reflected in the letters that Steve and I get for the podcast.
Really?
So many people having real problems in their intimate relationships. People have broken up with people because they voted for Trump or Clinton around the family tables, going home, talking to the uncle who says something racist, or confronting the mother who really disagrees on issues that are, I think, more than ever seeming not political, but rather personal, rather close to the heart. And the only thing I can say about that is what my hope is that we are in a time of great change, that things are tumultuous right now, not because they're always going to be so divisive or they're going to stay as angry and rageful and scary as they are right now, but rather this is what our evolution requires, that the system be disturbed. The silver lining for me in all of this conflict that's gone on and then on the national stage is that people are waking up and examining their own lives and thinking about, you know, how their personal lives are connected to their political values. A lot of people who were complacent, who didn't think that they needed to be active citizens to live in this democracy, have changed their minds. And I think their lives because of it. And I think this will be reflected soon in our nation in ways that are more positive than many of us are experiencing now.
You're picking up on that from the letters you receive?
Picking up on it from the letters I receive. And I guess the things I perceive as a person. I could be wrong. I'm an optimist.
Yeah. So that you talked about this profound compassion that you feel for people, this connection, radical empathy. Are you having that experience with Trump voters who write to you? Really?
Yeah, no, it's a hard one for me. It's a great question because it actually has been a struggle for me to really try to have compassion for people who have extremely different values. And this has been something I think that every person has grappled with who has, you know, somebody they care about, or in my case, somebody who's written to me who voted for Trump or who says, hey, I don't disagree with some of these statements that he's made, is, you know, where do you live out your conscience and where do you speak truth where you can? And where do you put those things aside and in some ways, privilege the relationship you have with that person? Certainly with a letter writer, that's a pretty easy divide for me. I can address somebody on the terms they've addressed me and try to offer whatever wisdom or counsel I have to muster. But in personal relationships, I think that's a lot harder because I feel personally betrayed by, people who are close to me who espouse racist views or misogynistic views, for example. I feel like I don't take that as a political threat. I take that as a personal affront. And I do think that it's okay to be a person of conscience at the same time as being kind. It's not unkind to say to somebody, you can't say those things about women in my presence. I will not have dinner with you or share Thanksgiving dinner with you if you say racist things about, my friends.
That's not a judgment you shy away from.
Those aren't judgments. Those are statements where you are saying, here is my boundary.
Yeah.
This is what I demand if we are to be in relation with each other, if you are to spend time with me. And I don't think I think there's a difference. It's a very fine point. There's a difference between being judgmental and telling and speaking your conscience and telling others what your boundaries are.
Cheryl Strayed is the author of Wild, of course, and the Dear Sugars podcast and the book Beautiful Little Things.
Tiny Beautiful Things.
Sorry. Tiny Beautiful
it's
Things.
It's hard when it's three words, Bill. I get it.
It's three is so much.
Your max is two words.
It really is. Dear Sugar, I can do. Cheryl
right.
Strayed, see?
People call it the Dear Sugar book by Cheryl Strayed. So yeah, Tiny Beautiful Things. Which was made into a play last year in New York, and now it's traveling to various cities. Very exciting to see that on the stage.
Cheryl Strayed walked from California to the Washington border. She lives in Portland now, and she's here for you were doing a fundraiser today for Youth East Side Services.
That's right.
It does work that's important to you. Thanks for making KUOW a stop, Cheryl.
Oh, it was wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.
Please come on back. We'll talk
I
about
will.
Something else. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I hope you'll stay tuned. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. There's a new study out of how to make people act against climate change. The researchers showed participants three fake weather forecasts. The first one they considered to be straightforward.
Thank you, Karen. And now for the weather you should not ignore. It's going to be another wet and potentially dangerous day in the Northeast tomorrow as hazardous rain continues to fall and flooding begins to rise.
The second forecast was scary.
Thank you, Karen. And now for the weather you can't afford to ignore. Thousands of lives remain at risk as flooding in the Northeast continues to rise following days of torrential downpour linked to human influence on the climate system. A careless and reckless consideration of our climate has put countless citizens in danger and devastated communities and homes nationwide.
And the third and final weather forecast was silly.
Thanks, Karen. And now for the weather I don't fully understand. Up first, we look to the Northeast, where heavy rain and flooding is expected for what seems like the 20th day in a row. And at this point, I have to assume that the clouds are simply stuck. But there's no other explanation. They've somehow gotten themselves fixed in one position, a cloud traffic collision maybe, and now they're wringing themselves dry over and over again in an attempt to move.
And you had words coming up explaining the actual weather facts that the bumbling weatherman didn't know. And each video ended with a call to action telling viewers to find out where your local officials stand on climate change. So, the results. Overall, the video that got the most people to contact politicians was the scary video. Although, for the youngest viewers, the humor video worked the best. For their next study, the researchers say they're going to try a different type of humor. Instead of lampooning a bumbling weatherman, they'll go with something harder-edged, a John Oliver-type takedown of industrial polluters or hypocritical politicians. The researchers say they want to know whether anger-inducing satire might be the best motivator of all. This is The Record on KOW. I'll let you know how that study turns out. Now, speaking of climate change, let's turn a little north to Vancouver, BC, where Governor Inslee went a few days ago and signed on to the anti-oil pipeline movement. There's a pipeline that moves oil from Alberta to the Port of Vancouver. Alberta wants to expand that pipeline, which would dramatically increase the number of oil tankers in Washington waters. Governor Inslee opposes the project. What about climate change, he says? What about carbon pollution? What about oil spills? What about the orca whales? But some people in Canada are saying, what about the hypocrisy? Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Good morning, Bill.
How would our governor be arguably hypocritical here?
Well, you got a member of the BC legislature, actually. I'll give you an example because he's been fairly dramatic on this issue. So the guy's name is Ellis Ross. He's a native Canadian, also a member of the legislature, supporter of pipeline development and LNG development here as well. And since the governor's visit, every day on Twitter, he's been tweeting out the routes, the names, and the pictures of oil tankers visiting, coming and going from the refineries in Washington state. So there are five oil refineries in Washington state. Several of them get Alaska oil. Several of them ship out oil as well. So it's one a day thereabouts. And basically the message, and it's been echoed in other Canadian news media as well, is we've been putting up with your oil tankers since 1971 when the Cherry Point refinery first opened. And you're now worried about our tankers? What about all the tankers you bring in, come and go yourselves? If you're really worried about oil tankers, why don't you close your refineries as a good example to us?
Right. Those Alaska tankers are chugging them right along your coast a lot longer than we have these Vancouver tankers suspending along our coast.
Now, yes. And look, in fairness, Canada and the United States have worked together on this issue. There are protocols. There are agreements to manage the risk. The tankers bound for Washington state. There's all kinds of protocols in place. They avoid certain parts of the BC coast. And obviously, the two countries have had to work together for a long time. But I think the theme raised, as I said, by this BC politician and others is, why work so hard to stifle development of our oil and gas industry while, as I read it, and I just heard a news reference to this from you, American oil production has increased, what, 250% over the last 10 years? If you're interested in keeping Canada from exporting oil overseas, well, as I say, you know, look at your own industry, which has increased massively. Your own production has increased massively, and one of the reasons Canada is trying to, or the province of Alberta is trying to develop oil to ship it overseas, is so we'd be less of a captive market from the United States. The feeling here, the analysis here, is that by having really only one customer for Canadian oil, other than Canadians themselves, we sell our oil at a discount to American refineries. Some of the American refineries that get this Canadian oil from that pipeline that comes into Vancouver are the ones in Washington state. There's a spur line that leaves from the Fraser Valley in Vancouver, and it goes down and it services some of the refineries in Washington state. And some of those refineries have already spoken up and said they'd be interested in more oil if more oil's available. And, of course, that oil is coming from Canada.
Yes, I understand the pipeline company, Kinder Morgan, cited Washington state as one of the target customers of this project that Governor Inslee doesn't like. We have seen protests, some Kai activists here, and, of course, there's the protest in Vancouver. Do British Columbians, how do they feel about Washington state's role in the oil tankers that traverse your waters? Are there anti-Washington state protests?
No, you know, I don't even think it's that well known. Mm-hmm. Look, when Cherry Point first opened and the Alaska tankers first started coming south, when the big accident occurred with the Exxon Valdez, there's lots of awareness here in British Columbia, and there were protests and opposition. That's one of the reasons we have these protocols where the tankers stay and avoid certain parts of the BC coast and all that. It's one of the reasons that Canadians are worried that we should be stepping up our oil spill prevention and clean up resources, because there are good resources on the American side. The other thing to note, Bill, is we've been lucky so far. There hasn't been a huge spill in these waters from Alaskan oil in a long time. I think the last one was the one in Port Angeles, Washington, about 30 years ago. There was a spill there. And there has been nothing, as you know, on the scale of the Exxon Valdez, which was millions of gallons of oil.
Right.
There have been some barge accidents. There's barge shipping along the coast. As I said, no one in Canada pretends they have clean hands. I don't think that would be fair. But there is a concern of why is the United States so interested in shutting down our oil production when you're so busy increasing yours?
Well said, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, framing the issue for you today. Vaughn, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, Bill.
The Record is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, a conversation about tech and tech bros. Emily Chang, author of Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. That's tomorrow at noon. And that's all for today. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.